And when I looked closer, there was a Sasquatch face on the other side, and was looking right back in at us.
Staring back at me is a silhouette of a very, very giant monkey.
An intriguing discovery is being investigated in a community east of Seattle. Someone came across a lengthy trail of extremely large footprints.
They are up there.
Welcome, everyone. You've tuned into the Nicola Valley Bigfoot Podcast, a place where your encounters are told. To share your encounter and to be on the show, email me at nicolavalleybigfoot@gmail.com. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
The interest really kind of began as a child, like a lot of other people. I think it's sort of almost become a common refrain at this point that, you know, those of us who grew up in the 70s and early 80s used to watch a lot of those shows on TV and everything. And I won't get into all that because I think we all know what those are. But there's another kind of factor that really pulled me in, and that was I was an early reader of John Green's books as a kid. And so when I was young, I used to go to the library with my mom, and I somehow found myself in the unexplained section of the library, and I don't know how or why I gravitated there, but and saw his books and just started to read them. And I was an early reader. Like, I learned to read fairly kind of advanced, or let's say kind of adult books, like by, you know, 7, 8, 9, that kind of thing. So I just got into his chronologies of reports, and that pretty much hooked me, in conjunction with like the pop culture side of the phenomenon that was raging at that time.
Yeah, I think a lot of people begin that fascination with Sasquatch, you know, as a youngster. I mean, I'm in that same boat. I remember reading a book in grade 4 that, you know, really lit that fire with the fascination of Sasquatch, and it's always been with me. It's something that for some reason, the Sasquatch has this way of pulling you in and captivating you. And where did that motivate? Was that the motivation that you used when you started writing this book?
So yeah, the book came later. The book was sort of, you know, that was a project that had begun, in 2013. So in that interim period, again, like a lot of other people, this is sort of a reflection of a lot of people's experiences. Like, when I got into adulthood and everything, I let go of the subject a little bit. You know, there was also kind of a lull in the whole Sasquatch cultural phenomenon thing, like just prior to the internet. Like, it's almost as if it sort of, the subject went a bit dead in the TV and the movie world. So but then again, like, just after, you know, 2000 or so, a little in those early 2000 years, like some interesting things happened to kind of pull me back in. And again, these are kind of more like life events, I would say. And so one was that I'm, you know, I live in Toronto, and at the time, I don't remember what year it was. Again, it might have been like 2000, 2001. A woman who worked at a job that I was at had apparently gone up north to her cottage along a kind of a wooded, rugged area known here as the Niagara Escarpment. So pretty close to like Georgian Bay, Lake Huron area, an area called Collingwood here. And she had told a colleague that her and her boyfriend had run across this creature at night crossing the road. And so obviously I, you know, with my experience and a rather kind of like familiarity or knowledge with the subject, kind of ran to her, and kind of, it took a few weeks to get her to open up about it, but she ended up kind of telling me that, you know, she'd seen this creature. She didn't know what it was. And again, this was before Google. And so, and before the subject had really kicked in again, once the internet was, you know, brought to the community together, essentially. And so I just found it completely fascinating at the time that she had, you know, had this experience, and also very far away from the usual quarters where this, you know, Bigfoot thing tends to take place, kind of thing, right here in Ontario, right? And you know, not even a couple hours from Toronto. And so those sorts of things kind of really brought me back into it. And so what actually really catalyzed the book, the actual direct sort of series of events, was in 2012, I traveled to the British Columbia coast to work on a travel feature, because I'm you know, not just a journalist and a you know, done, you know, documentary news reporting, but I also work, you know, I've done work as a travel writer. So I was out doing a magazine assignment on an area known as the Great Bear Rainforest, which is kind of a sort of an informal designation for essentially kind of parts of the central and north coast of British Columbia, where the, you know, towns of Bella Bella, Bella Coola, Klemtu, all of these sorts of familiar nodes of Bigfoot activity are. And the, you know, the intent was to kind of go do essentially like a travel adventure piece. And you know, I mean, I knew that those places from John Green's books, because he used to go up there, were related to Sasquatch, but the intent was not necessarily to do something Sasquatch related. However, when I got there, it was the summer of 2012, and for some reason, and this may kind of relate to, I guess, the cyclical nature of reports in certain places, that summer was a very, very active summer for reports. And so when I got into these communities, Bella Bella being the seat of the Heltsuk First Nation, Bella Coola, the Newhawk, and, you know, Klemtu, the Kitisu Jejes, it was all people were talking about. And so being really interested in the subject and having grown up with it and having kind of been reawoken to the subject through, you know, stories of certain people and all that, like in real life, I became really transfixed by it. And I'm like, wow, I'm actually in these places. It's actually happening. And I started to kind of, you know, take time, almost all of my time, away from the travel journalism side of the work and started to kind of like, you know, ask questions, investigate. Like, I kind of became an investigator in a way, right? Like, from that moment, because the towns were buzzing and they were simultaneously buzzing, which was the funny thing. And, you know, they're, you know, quite a far distance from each other on the coast. And so by the end of the trip, like the 2 weeks passed and I was ready to go back, and I'd kind of fallen in love with the place. And I was so interested and excited by these reports. And I was thinking about writing a book about something. I wanted to do a travel memoir. And so I decided, like, in the day or two before I, you know, before I left, that I would come back again the following summer and do a trip and write about it in book form. And that's how In the Valleys of the Noble Beyond kind of came to be.
Wow. It almost came to you by accident in some respect.
Yeah, it was, it was very kind of serendipitous. And I'll say something about this region of BC. And I don't know whether it may have to do with the demographics or just, there's a lot of synchronicity and serendipity when you go to these places. And also too, I mean, I think a lot of people will perhaps agree that, like, when you're kind of doing stuff that you love and, or are, you know, kind of in that sort of area where you're doing things that you're actually really, really interested in and, or, you know, have an aptitude for, like, the world, the universe, I don't know, whatever terminology you want to use, tends to kind of meet you halfway. And I found that was the case when I went on that trip and for the trip that I did for the book. It was, there was a lot of that happening.
Did you stick mostly to British Columbia? I mean, you know, British Columbia is well known for their Sasquatch activity. Is that why you chose British Columbia? I mean, you could have chosen anywhere, in to be honest. I mean, there's sightings all across Canada and the U.S. as well. Like, what was it about British Columbia that drew you back here to do your research for your book?
For sure. Yeah, no, for one, I feel a kinship with the land that is BC or in BC, let's say. And yes, I did spend a bit of time in the West Kootenays, in the Nelson area, which is also known for a lot of activity. It's a little bit sort of below the radar in a popular sense. Like, it's not like, you know, the Harrison Lake area where its connections are obvious, right? But to the subject, but I've always had this, it really comes down to my personality. I really have this, I'm really drawn to the aesthetic and ecological beauty of the ocean meeting the mountains. Like, the coast for me really speaks to me. And so, and whenever I've kind of read about the coast, looked at photographs of it, even kind of looked at like the provincial parks and the recreation, the conservancies and everything, like when I used to do kind of research, there's just something about that area really, really, really appealed to me. And so it just seemed to me like the most beautiful and wild and ecologically productive place. It seemed to me like that was sort of the Shangri-La that Sasquatches would kind of penultimately exist in, if you take my meaning. And so, I've always kind of, just a sort of a personal preference. We're all drawn to different parts of the world. And I also wanted to kind of know more about the indigenous perspectives and meet the people from those communities. And I'd never really kind of been there. And being from Ontario, being from Toronto in particular, we didn't really grow up here learning a lot about, you know, indigenous communities, those issues. I mean, it's a Canada-wide thing. There was a bit of a blackout in educationally, but I think even more so here because in the big city here, you're at very arm's length from that world and from that culture. And so I also wanted to go there and get to know the people in those places.
Well, yeah, British Columbia is definitely, to me, it is the most beautiful place on the planet. John, you mentioned that you went to these communities, these First Nations communities, and you talked to Indigenous peoples about Sasquatch. And was there anything that kind of surprised you, in terms of their belief systems or what they thought about Sasquatch? And the reason I ask, and let me preface this, is that even in my own learning, every culture seems to be a little bit different. There's a little bit difference in each culture's belief in who the Sasquatch are and what their role is on the planet. Like, was there anything that kind of surprised you about that?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a few things stuck out. I would say the thing that surprised me the most, and this probably speaks to my own biases and to probably to even other people's beliefs, is that, like, not all Indigenous people are like acknowledge their existence, and I was sort of going into the community thinking that it would be this kind of like uniform unanimous kind of understanding where I talked to a lot of people there, like in the different communities, and like a lot of people were like, no, there's no such thing, or like, no, I never seen one, so they can't exist. And so, granted, there are also a lot of people that do, but in terms of surprise, that was one surprise for me. And then, I've had other people from those communities say, well, yeah, it's kind of normal for us. Like, we have our unbelievers here in these communities as well, and we have to kind of like deal with them and the whole, in the sense, like, kind of like endure their kind of like, comments kind of thing about their not being the creatures. But, so that was one. I found there was kind of like a general sort of split too between people who, in those communities, who felt that seeing one was a generally positive thing, and those who felt that seeing them was not such a positive thing, right? And so, and again, that boils down to kind of areas. I mean, I would say in Bella Bella, they take a more sort of positively philosophical approach to it, where they say that seeing one is sort of like, there, you know, there's a reason to see one. It's meant for you to kind of examine an aspect of your life that needs to be worked on, or, and it's kind of a generally sort of like a fortuitous thing, like a blessing in a way. I found that in Bella Coola, more often than not, it was met with fear, more than what I just described than on the Bella Bella side. And again, I don't want to generalize and sort of pigeonhole either place into that perspective or the other. I'm just sort of saying that kind of like what I found at the time was the case. And so that really stuck out. And then a third thing that stuck out is, again, it's not so much surprise, but just sort of more something that I noticed, was that the whole UFO thing didn't really come up very much. And again, not that I was expecting it to, but I found that like people either said they didn't know or they weren't really that much interested in that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Or even had, you know, so, you know, and I spoke to a lot of people, and again, and so that didn't really come up. And then the last sort of, let's say, dichotomy, was that a lot of people from those communities also just thought the creature was flesh and blood. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, others see them as a hybrid of both material, immaterial. And again, all to say that the perspectives, there's a variety of perspectives. And so there wasn't really kind of one take on it, in the same way that there isn't really one take across North America with all of the different peoples.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very common misconception that all First Nations or Indigenous communities share the same belief when it comes to Sasquatch. And the reason I asked you that question is because, you know, your answer is exactly the same as mine. I found in talking to different people from different areas or different territories, their belief systems are, you know, they're close enough to be considered similar, but they're different enough that, you know, they could be taken on their own merits. And that's what I found even talking to people in my own area. You go from one Indian band to another, and the differences are subtle, but they're still there. And you know, it could be like you mentioned, it could be you don't want to see one, or you're lucky to see one. And you know, for the most part, it's always, you know, they're, it's a good thing to see one. If you do see one, it's definitely a good thing. And that's what I found anyway. Were any of your own personal expectations, were they shattered by anything that you might have heard along your travels in researching the book?
Let me just ask you, like, when you say my personal expectations, do you mean?
Well, you must have had some kind of image in your head, or some kind of thought process that you had regarding Sasquatch before you went into these communities and started talking to people. There must have been something in your mind that, you know, okay, this is Sasquatch. It could have been like the image of the Patterson-Gimlin footage, or you know, legends that you might have heard beforehand that,
okay,
you
okay.
know, maybe Sasquatch were stealing kids or stealing women, you know, or you know, maybe they're curious beasts, or maybe they can travel interdimensionally. Was there anything that you thought about Sasquatch going into it that was kind of shattered and changed your perception on what Sasquatch is or who they are after talking to the peoples in the area and doing your own research? Was there anything that was there anything that changed your mind, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
I mean, not in a really, really big picture sense. I mean, I think there's a bit of a feedback kind of loop in the culture. I mean, there are the sort of original understandings and stories and beliefs that the communities kind of have that go back. But then I think they're also exposed to, you know, the books as well, and then the TV shows. I think Finding Bigfoot had already kind of, you know, was close to running its course at that time. And so there was a lot of reflecting back to me of a lot of notions that I think those of us who live outside of those places have about Sasquatch. But I think if there was any sort of changes that I had in terms of my perspective, it's this sort of idea that the creatures kind of, like, they took different forms in a way. Like there were mentions of like small Sasquatches, like the little people that are referred to sometimes, like a separate almost species or race of beings, and Sasquatches that are like really tall and lanky, others that are like don't have hair. And so like I did kind of hear a lot of stories kind of describing, you know, different types of like purported humanoids that had been sort of seen or encountered, sort of thing. And so and you know, that has come up, you know, in other contexts and everything, that they're, you know, when you talk about when you hear about the skunk ape, sometimes it's sort of like, you know, there was a picture that kind of made it look a bit like a chimpanzee or something. And so there's this idea that maybe different parts of the continent have maybe slightly different variations of the creature. But in terms of the coast itself, there seems to be a variety within the kind of the different sort of nations on the coast and everything. And so I didn't really go into my travels kind of knowing that as much. And I would say, that changed. But something that I'd also heard of that, you know, was an addition to whatever knowledge I'd picked up over the years, was that, you know, I was told that like these communities kind of had relations with the Sasquatch, like in the deep past. Mm-hmm. Like they would trade items with them. They would communicate with them. Like there was some kind of like, there was contact between them, kind of thing. And I'm not sure whether that is also the case with other nations or communities in North America or whatever, but that was something that I'd not really heard of before, that they were kind of aware of each other and knew each other and, you know, sort of not just kept the distance from each other, but like, there's a familiarity between the two groups in the way that like two nations or two countries or two communities would have connections with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And that goes back for hundreds of years. I mean, I'm not sure exactly at what point in time, you know, Sasquatch and humanity kind of decided to separate and go their own different paths. But, you know, it kind of can be traced back to when the settlers began, you know, heading west. And that's kind of when, you know, I think the Sasquatch seen what was coming. Right. And they decided they didn't want to really be a part of it, which I can't really blame them. I mean, they get to live in a beautiful forest, and we kind of ruin that. But so you go out into these communities, John, and you're talking to the locals, the indigenous population, and whoever else you decided to speak with. But, you know, did you actually get out into the field? Like, did you go out and do any field research in terms of, you know, maybe looking for tracks, you know, or structures, or actually trying to have a sighting of your own?
Yeah. So for people who don't know the area so well, these are essentially communities that are, they're in a very remote area. There isn't really a lot of road infrastructure on the coast. A lot of travel is by boat. Very rugged, and a lot more rugged as you get more, as you approach the interior from the outer coast or the islands. And so, so in a sense, the short answer in a way is yes, in that, because the edge of each community is essentially backcountry, it doesn't really take a great deal of, you know, time to kind of get to a place where there would potentially be, you know, evidence and that sort of thing. So I did spend a lot of time hiking. a few trails. There isn't really a lot of trail infrastructure, but there's also animal trails. I've gone off with certain individuals in their boats, and I was taken kind of, we did go into like many parts of the Great Bear, and just kind of poked around basically. And I didn't do so much any kind of like overnight camping or that kind of thing. Only because I think my focus was to just sort of spend time with characters and to be sort of shown around and taken around. But we did go back a bunch of times, and in one case there were tracks, that small tracks that were found on the edge of Bella Bella, in mud, in the area of a lake where the original community the original site of the community, kind of thing. And so it was you know, like I was writing a travel memoir in a sense. So in a way, like, this isn't coming so much from a hardcore field investigator who, you know, will be very technical and go out and do a bunch of things. I was sort of trying to strike a balance between, you know, being a storyteller and writing about characters and also going out and describing places and writing about the history. And so it was a layered book that I was looking to write. And so that also kind of informed my movements. And a lot of those movements were also finding stories and chasing down contacts and going from one contact to the next, to the next, to the next. So it was a lot more, my emphasis was I think a lot more on the sort of the human, the cultural side, the eyewitness side, a little bit of the phenomenon. And then because being in town and being on the edge of town, you are in essence like putting yourself in the way of possible encounters and possible evidence in a way that's different from, say, being in a big city where, you know, it's even though the edges, like the edges of, like, you know, Vancouver or another community, you know, will get maybe reports, but sporadically.
Yeah. I have to ask, did you find anything? In terms of evidence? I mean, footprints obviously you found, but did you hear whoops or anything?
It was just tracks. So it was just tracks for that trip. And again, like, the year before was the really, 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 really active year, it seemed. And then as happens, things went quiet. And so when I was there, it seemed as though, like, whatever had been there the year before had withdrawn somewhat. So, and again, my trip was only 3 months, right? So, like, when you talk to the more hardcore investigators, I mean, they're spending years of their lives, and then, you know, like, it'll take them quite a long time to find something. Whereas I had a very, very concentrated 3 month trip, right, in the summer sort of thing. So and it's your luck, right? So however there is a bit of an epilogue to the whole story, in a sense. So did my trip, went back a whole bunch of times to the region to write the book. I spent years basically you know, like, periods of time over years going back to the region and to kind of sort of familiarize myself more with it and to do follow-up research and to actually write parts of the book, which helped a great deal. But once the book was done and edited and kind of, like, you know, wrapped and signed off on, and we were just waiting to do like the promotion and the book cover and all that for it. There's that kind of period of a year when you're done a book to the time it launches. And I was working with a New York publisher on it, and you know, we just signed off on all of the edits and the proofreading and everything. And I went on a camping trip with a few people, two friends, to Cape Scott Provincial Park on the northwest tip of Vancouver Island. And this was the summer of 2018. It was late August, very late August, just before Labor Day weekend. And we were coming back from 5 days of camping on the beach, because that's what Cape Scott really, that's its draw, right? You go beach camping up there, right? So we were on our way back to the lot, and we decided to do one more night in a kind of a more of a slightly interior campsite, which was just maybe like an 8 hour hike from the ocean. And there was nobody else there. It's like, was a site of about 30 kind of, you know, campsites kind of thing. Late in the afternoon, some Irish travelers came in. There was maybe three or four people that came there from Ireland, and it was just us. And it was on the kind of on a little lake in the park, small lake, and very much the same ecosystem as the Great Barrier Rainforest, like, you know, just that kind of really, really kind of coastal temperate rainforest. And there was just something about the site. We'd gotten there, and it was just so quiet and just so kind of like, just so eerie and still. And I don't know, like, you know, that kind of uncomfortable feeling that, that people talk about it. And I was sort of joking to my friends. I'm like, you know, this kind of reminds me of places up on the coast, where people generally don't go, or that have like reports, Sasquatches tied to them, and like that, you know. So we kind of made a joke. We called it like Sasquatch Lake or whatever, and you know, we were kind of kidding around or whatever. And so, anyway, just to jump ahead, we made dinner. We kind of hung out by the lake a little bit, all of us, and you know, we'd like made a little fire and the whole thing. And anyway, the Irish people returned to their tent. They were getting up early to go to the beach campsites early the next morning. And then one of my buddies went back to his camp, his tent. The campsite's in the trees, and we're out by the water. And so just after things got really, really, really dark at around 10 p.m. or so, you know, myself and my friend started hearing like rocks being like falling into the water, like splashes. And at first it was kind of like there was something maybe, we thought at first there was something swimming kind of thing, like that was the initial reaction. Like there was a splash, and then we kind of both stood up, and but then afterwards it was like this kind of like kerplunk, like this kind of almost like that kind of was a like glunk, kind yeah. of like something, you know, heavy falling into the water next to us. And so it pretty soon kind of became apparent that like some like objects were being thrown into the water. We'd had our headlamps off, and I think we just basically panicked and like grabbed our stuff and like ran back to the campsite. And like this kind of fight or flight response thing kicked in, and I kind of, having heard all of these stories over the course of my travels and through the course of my life, having, you know, read the books and everything, I like, by the time I got back to the tent, like I kind of knew what was possibly happening. And then like within about 20 minutes or so, there was another huge crashing sound, like not crashing through the bush, but like almost sort of like, you know, like when you hear a construction site and like there's like a pile driver, there's like banging or some kind of like loud kind of like crashing kind of bang, like almost like a boulder being thrown into other boulders, or like something really heavy kind of, I don't know, like colliding with something else. That came from the exact area that we were kind of standing in. And so like, and it was so loud. And I was the only one who heard it after that, but like, cause, you know, my other friend went to bed or whatever, but like, yeah. So I didn't see it. I don't know if it was for sure or whatever, but, yeah, we couldn't really think like the next day of what else it could have been.
Yeah.
So, and all to say, I mean, in a way, the reason, and one of the main reasons I mention it is because it's kind of ironic that, like, after all of sort of all of the visits to the Great Bear and the traveling and the snooping and the investigating and the sleuthing and the whole thing, like it came to me when I wasn't really, when I wasn't looking for it. Like, to be honest, like after I finished writing the, I kind of hoped that by writing the book, I would, you know, sort of like move on a little bit from the subject, like move on from a kind of an upset, like not an obsessive sense. Like, I wouldn't call myself obsessive, but you know how it is with the subject, right? Like, yeah, it's so interesting and so addictive and so kind of cool and stuff that like, you kind of can't get enough sort of thing. Right. So,
I
was sort of hoping like, okay, like this is going to be my contribution, which would be kind of a multidisciplinary exploration of it through a travel memoir, and that I would like, you know, and I kind of was happy with sort of how I left it at the end of the book and how I, and what contribution I made to the, let's say, discussion or the debate, which for me was more philosophical. I really kind of wanted to, I'm like, okay, it's done. I've put it out. It's coming out. It's like, but, and then all of a sudden it's like, nope, you're back in again, you know? So it's like, you know, it's almost kind of, you know, in a kind of metaphorical way, like the like the animals going like, you know, don't think you can kind of come in and kind of like put your two cents in and sort of, you know, just kind of walk off kind of thing, like, you know, so it's, anyway, I mean, it is what it is, but yeah. So, I mean, in a sense, even though that didn't happen to me during the travels that made up the book, I still consider that experience to be part of the process, the whole process tied in with the book. So, and I tried to include it sort of in an appendix or in an epilogue or whatever. Like there is actually an epilogue to the story in the book. But I think, you know, I wasn't self-publishing it like a lot of Sasquatch people do with their book. So the decision wasn't mine. And I think, both, Grove Atlantic, the American publisher in New York, and, Greystone Books in Vancouver that had acquired it, thought it might be a bit sort of, you know, not too much, but just, I think they were happy with the way that it ended and they didn't want to sort of almost like subvert the ending of my book, which they thought was eloquent enough by kind of casting kind of, you know, revisiting the question all over again once the readers read the book kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there you have it.
Yeah. Well, Sasquatch still kind of remains on the fringe of mainstream science, and it's not quite, you know, accepted amongst science or journalism for that matter. Did you face any obstacles or any setbacks, you know, in terms of writing this book? I mean, and what I mean by that, like, were any of your colleagues like kind of questioning your motives or your reasoning for writing such a book on something that's technically, you know, not supposed to exist? Was there any hurdles that you had to overcome?
You know, I can't crystal ball what goes through people's minds, obviously, like all of us. And I'm sure there were some individuals, who may have kind of laughed at me, you know, in their own mind. And I did encounter a few people, you know, who did sort of cast aspersions about what I was doing, but they were often more members of the public. But I would say that on the whole, no, people, you know, this is another surprising thing. I found people to be very interested and supportive, actually. I was at the time working in the national newsroom at CBC. And so I think a lot of people were really kind of like, you know, a little bit, like, you know, interested and envious. Oh, you know, you're trying, like, there was a lot of kind of actual interest, you know, in the subject. And I found that to be, you know, a lot to be the case with the general public too. Like, because, you know, I'm working on a project that took me several years. It comes up in conversations, right? You're meeting people, you're meeting friends of friends, you're out on social occasions, you meet strangers for whatever reason, and they ask you what you're doing or what you're up to, and you tell them. And so I was really, really pleasantly surprised by how many sort of lay people or people in the general public were genuinely fascinated by that project and by that subject. And, you know, ironically, this is kind of one of the great ironies, right? Like, in a place like Toronto, which, you know, you have to really drive about 2 or 3 good hours to get into any sort of like real, you know, real forest or bush, and where Sasquatch isn't really kind of a thing. It's sort of the furthest thing from people's imaginations here. You know, in places like that, like, there was the most interest. And so in the places where I got kind of disparaged the most, believe it or not, was like Vancouver.
What?
Like, I found Vancouverites. And again, I'm not, this isn't a generalization, but I found way more skepticism in Van than I've encountered maybe like anywhere. And I don't know. And maybe it's because Vancouverites and some British Columbians are just like sick. They've heard the stories over and over again. They're sick of it. They're sick of the topic. They don't want to be like, maybe it's like Squatchy, the mascot from the Olympics, or I don't know. Right. Maybe they've just kind of like had it up to here with it. And so, like, you know, and I guess also too, you have a lot of people in British Columbia who like have spent a lot of time in the backcountry. Have worked in logging, work in industry, and they've never seen anything like that in their entire life. So I did also get a lot of pushback from like kind of, you know, like logger, miner in industry kind of worker people who just would I had one guy outright laugh at me when I was waiting for like a Pacific Coastal flight between, I think it was Port Hardy and I don't know wherever else I was going. It might have been Bella Bella, I don't know. And so so my colleagues were cool. People were generally cool. I think as kind of a cross section of the BC public were kind of like, they didn't like it very much. I don't know. So, or maybe because I was from Toronto or something, I don't know. But,
well, if I may, when I started this podcast, you know, I kind of wanted to focus on British Columbia because, you know, British Columbia is well known for its Sasquatch activity. And I thought, well, I want the rest of the world to kind of know about this. And so when I started the podcast, I was going to mainly focus on British Columbia, not knowing kind of what you were just alluding to, though, is that not many people in British Columbia want to talk about it. And it's either, you know, logging is such an influence here that, you know, loggers don't want to. You know, for the most part, they spent their whole lives in the forest and never seen anything. So therefore that can't be a real thing. So don't bother me with this. Or on the other end of the spectrum, it has to be, well, everybody already knows they're out there. Why do you want to talk about it? It'd be like me doing a podcast about a deer. Do you know what I mean? There's two polar opposites when it comes to it in British Columbia. That's what I found anyway. And that's kind of, that's even true today. I mean, I struggle to find people that want to talk about Sasquatch in British Columbia. It's not the easiest thing to do. Or if I go to certain indigenous peoples, you know, their belief system that pertains to Sasquatch is where it would be disrespectful to tell the stories about them. So, you know, there's always that little thing in British Columbia. It's kind of a weird hodgepodge of reactions when it comes to Sasquatch. I can't explain it. I wish I could, but
for sure. And I mean, just, you know, to contrast that, like up in Bella Bella, some of the community members there, it's such a normal thing to them. I mean, I wrote this in the book, like it was a dialogue with one person where, you know, she told me, you know, like this is a regular animal in the forest for us. And she said, when I was growing up and discovered how other people regarded the subject with so much exoticism and awe and fascination. And, you know, she said, I was generally surprised, because here for us, it's sort of, it's a normal part of the landscape. It's a part of our world. And yeah, it makes total sense. Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, and for a guy like me coming from, you know, I mean, I grew up in a leafy suburb of Toronto. I wasn't in the concrete. I'm in the concrete now. I've kind of devolved in that way. But for, you know, when you're from a place like this, in which you're cut off from those sorts of wonders or those sorts of phenomenon, it can be very appealing. Like the idea, and that was the reason why, I mean, if there was a true reason I wanted to write the book, it was to really, like, at a very deep level, more than kind of finding evidence, more than like, I didn't like the whole, is there or is there not a Sasquatch question thing, that kind of binary duality. It was what I really wanted to, like, explore is, like, you know, like, what is the appeal? You know, what drives us? What charges our fascination with it, kind of thing? And so I think that went to the root of me understanding why I was really kind of, you know, obsessed by it for so long as a kid, and even still to some degree as an adult. It was an exploration that I thought could potentially also speak to other people, because I think a lot of us don't, you know, even, like, I met John Bindernagel and spent time with him. I even knew John from before. I didn't mention that in the book, but, like, often when I sat with him, like, he never, when I asked him kind of, what is it that appeals to you about this subject? I mean, he gave me his scientific reasons or whatever. And I completely acknowledge all of that. But he didn't seem to be very aware or cognizant of something deeper driving him. And I think drives all of us and everything. And that is kind of almost sort of like the pursuit of wonder. Something almost kind of mystical about the Sasquatch, yeah. Something almost quasi-religious, this kind of being with superpowers almost in a way. And we kind of, I don't know, I think that speaks to something very ancient in us, something very kind of, something that kind of goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and where we sought to understand the universe better those things that influence it and all that. And so that's kind of what the book is actually about, beyond the kind of more surface, mundane, you know, like, is there, isn't there, and, you know, all that kind of stuff and everything. Which is, you know, kind of the reason why I didn't want to make it kind of about going out and camping for 5 days and then, you know, seeing the hand come against the tent and, you know, all the, you know, the, you know, like, it would have been really cool for that to happen or whatever. But I don't know. I was in pursuit of another bounty, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Well, humanity loves a mystery. I think that's just a natural part of our, you know, our DNA, is that we like to know things, and we like to try to figure things out. And I think that's where a lot of, you know, the curiosity comes from, you know, for outside people, is that, you know, what is it? What exactly is it? And I think that's a very natural reaction as well. But
sure.
John, let me ask you this last question before we wrap things up here. But you've written the book, you've gone through the process of researching and speaking with people and doing what you needed to do to get this book written, and you're happy with how it worked out and how it ended. But I have to ask, and I'm going to put you on the spot, but there's no wrong answer here. But after everything's said and done, what did you think that Sasquatch is, and what do you think it is now?
Right. So, I mean, I would say that kind of before I went to do the trip for the book, I was largely convinced of their existence. Let's say, like, this was, let's say if we go back to agnostically, maybe even 2012, 2013. And, but then for the exercise of writing the book, I kind of deliberately, I'm going to give you like a bit of the longer answer. I deliberately sort of decided to try and force upon myself a kind of almost like, someone who doesn't know kind of thing, just again, for the purposes of going out there. And then ever since then, I've kind of, I wouldn't say I flipped back and forth, but I've kind of like gone a bit more in one direction, gone a bit more in the other, depending on where I am, if I'm in the city or if I'm back out in BC or whatever. But I, you know, and this also then eventually takes into account the rock throwing incident. But I would say, and sorry, I'm going to answer your question. I mean, I would say that I suspect they're kind of like a sort of a human hybrid, like I don't know, something more feral, more great ape like, more animal, and something more human, and but with like a human type of intelligence. Now, not just intelligence, I would say that they're kind of self-aware, so they're kind of similar to us in that they're different from animals and that they're probably aware of their own awareness. If that makes any sense, because, yeah. and I think that speaks to the elusiveness thing, right? Whereas, you know, a deer or bear might just kind of like wander onto somebody's lawn or onto a road and not kind of, you know, care or whatever. Like, I think there's a kind of, there's an intelligence and a self-awareness here and of some understanding of danger tied to us that just keeps these things away from us. And then, you know, I guess being kind of a higher level being in nature, it, I don't know, perhaps has some like hyper intuitive or super intuitive or whatever you want to call abilities that are like, you know, more sixth sense, let's say, that allows them to kind of even be more sensitive to. So, yeah, I don't know. I would say, you know, kind of sort of feral humanoid with, you know, gifted with like, you know, intuitive abilities, I guess, because of their closeness to nature. That's the best I can really do. I don't know. And, you know, when it comes to like things like the portals and like the more supernaturally stuff, the orbs. And I mean, there's a whole, you know, I don't need to spell it out to the list. Like, we know what kind of all the kind of other areas that have accrued to the subject are. UFOs, I don't know. Like, I can't speak to that. Like, yeah. I don't know. So, yeah, I don't know. So I don't know if that's kind of that's an answer or not, but
that works. Yeah. But, it's definitely a rabbit hole that one can get trapped in if you decide to delve down that road, you know what I mean? I mean, you got the woo factor, which is more the supernatural portals, that sort of thing. And then you have the other camp where it's they're living, breathing, you know, warm-blooded mammals that are walking through the forest. So it definitely is a rabbit hole. And, you know, are you keeping it? Are you still doing like research like on your own, like just out of general curiosity?
I don't really kind of pursue it sort of, you know, consistently mechanically, let's say, but because I do travel out west quite a bit and because the book has attached itself to me and because it comes up, I do meet people, you know, like who've had reports like no joke. I was at an art gallery opening in Toronto a couple of weeks ago that my friend put on because he's an art dealer and he has got a gallery. And so I met somebody. I was looking at a painting on the wall that was a sort of a depiction of coastal BC. This guy comes up next to me. He's an Italian guy, Sicilian guy from Toronto here. And he's, you know, telling me how much he likes the painting. And he's like, reminds me of BC. And we get to talking. He'd lived out there as a guide outfitter in the Chilcotin for a bunch of years. And my book came up and he had an encounter so I do run into people and stuff who, the Toronto thing is a big anomaly. It's usually when I go back out west. I've been to Yukon. I've heard stories there, like they, you know, Washington State last year for that I did a library talk at Medellin Falls on the BC border that coincided with their Sasquatch festival, and so I talked to people like at the bar and stuff, and like the bartender and the waitresses and stuff, like they all had stories. So like it just comes. So I don't really pursue it sort of as a vocation, but when it comes up, the stories seem to crop up. So I write them down and kind of keep track of them sort of thing for fun.
I think that's a normal thing too. I have the same kind of experiences I'm known as the Bigfoot guy around here. And uh-huh. You know, whenever the subject comes up, people will tell me things that they normally wouldn't say to others, but I think Sasquatch has that effect on people. It has an effect on a lot of people, whether they realize it or not. So I think it's a completely normal reaction. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's total water cooler discussion. Like you can't ever bring it up. And I mean, I guess you can, and somebody will just roll their eyes and walk away. But, I find that it sort of guarantees a kind of a somewhat open-ended discussion anyway. So
absolutely. Well, John, this has been great. I really enjoyed having you on the show today. Once again, the book is called In the Valley of the Noble Beyond, In Search of Sasquatch. And you can find that anywhere. Amazon, you can order the paperback version on Amazon as well as the digital, and you can get it on Audible, Google Books. I'm sure Apple has it as well. You can pretty much find it anywhere. Just type in the book title, in the Valley of the Noble Beyond, and it'll pop up. John, is there anything else you'd like to promote before we end this one?
I've written a second book recently, and so I spent a couple decades. I mean, I still am. I'm a journalist and a writer, and I've spent a lot of time working in mainstream news, of all things, believe it or not, like at CBC and at Al Jazeera, and as a kind of as a freelancer writing for papers and everything. And so I published a book called Veils of Distortion, about essentially news media warp, to kind of explain to the public how and why the news organizations choose the stories that they do, report on them in the way that they do, and like kind of sort of the behind the scenes of like what actually happens in a newsroom. Because as you know, like in the last few years for me leading up to that book, people were asking me a lot, you know, to explain why the quality of news has plummeted and why it's become, you know, so biased depending on which organization, you know, produces it and everything. And so that kind of became the next book after Sasquatch, because I think they overlap a little bit in that I was taking kind of a psychology or a psychological or a behavioral perspective when looking kind of at the Sasquatch subject, and then it just I'm explaining in a sense why news organizations warp the news, basically. And so that's sort of the second book that came out.
Oh, awesome. And that can be found on Amazon and all the other big platforms.
That's available. Well. That's available everywhere. Yeah, everywhere as well, kind of thing. Yeah, for people who are kind of interested in getting the inside scoop on a CBC and Al Jazeera journalist's experiences, that may also appeal beyond the Great Bear Rainforest journey of the Sasquatch.
Yeah, awesome. And once again, his name is John Zada, which is Zada or Zada if you're in the US. And John, thank you so much again for coming on. I do appreciate you taking the time today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really fun.
Oh, pleasure is all mine. And for the listeners, if you guys just want to hang around, we're going to close out the show. Stay there. And we're back, everyone. We are back to pull a pin on this one, but of course we can't do that until we give John a huge thank you. John, thank you so much, buddy. I do appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today. I really enjoyed listening to your adventures researching this book. And if I may be so bold, it does take a lot of guts to move to the other side of the country to do research, you know, to live in the woods and to gather information, to talk to complete strangers, and hopefully that they're hospitable enough to welcome you and give you that information that you're looking for. So, ladies and gentlemen, check this book out. It is called, once again, ladies and gentlemen, check this book out. It's called In the Valleys of the Noble Beyond, In Search of Sasquatch. And John, I do owe you an apology because, oh man, I mispronounced the book title during the interview and I'm so embarrassed. It is such a rookie move, but it's actually In the Valleys with an S on it, plural. And I didn't add that when we were speaking. And John, I sincerely apologize. But for the listeners, if you guys want to check it out, it's available anywhere. Just give it a Google, and you can get it on Amazon. You can get a digital copy. You can get it pretty much anywhere you get books. And once again, it's called In the Valleys of the Noble Beyond, In Search of Sasquatch. And the author is named John Zada. So go check that out. John, thank you again, man. I really do appreciate it. Okay, I think we're going to wrap this one up, guys. But of course, we can't do that until we do this. If you've had an encounter and you want to be on the show, send me an email at NicolaValleyBigfoot@gmail.com. That's NICOLA. NicolaValleyBigfoot@gmail.com. Of course, I would love to hear from you. I get a lot of emails about previous shows, which means, you know, you guys are listening. So I do appreciate it. Thank you so much. And as far as the conference is going, I know you're kind of wondering about that. We're all moving forward. Poster will be released this week. So stay tuned for that. And until the next one, guys, I will talk to you all later. Bye.